Welcome to the ETOP Podcast with your host, Richard Walsh. I'm a 30-year business-owning veteran, creator of the ETOP Academy, and best-selling author of Escape the Owner Prison, the contract's new way to scale, regain control, and fast-track growth while loving life. My mission? To help 10,000 business owners create the freedom in their lives to do what they want, when they want, and still be massively successful. Now, let's hit our topic for the day. Welcome to the ETOP Podcast with your host, Richard Walsh. I'm a 30-year business-owning veteran, creator of the ETOP Academy, and best-selling author of Escape the Owner Prison, the contract's new way to scale, regain control, and fast-track growth while loving life. My mission? To help 10,000 business owners create the freedom in their lives to do what they want, when they want, and still be massively successful. Now, let's hit our topic for the day. Today's guest is Adam Adams. I'm excited to have Adam on because this is a topic we haven't done a lot of talking on, but as people know in my academy and things like that, it's a big focus that we do. So Adam's focus since before the crash of 2008, and we all know I've had my experience in that, he's been on real estate and construction. Okay, so Adam believes in replacing his construction income with passive income, and he's passionate about helping other people do the same thing. So this fits right into the ETOP model. I love it. Adam, I'm so happy to have you on here. Why don't you come on board? How are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you.
Oh, man, good to hear. Good to hear. Well, Adam, as I do with all my guests, I want you to bring us up to speed. I gave a little brief intro there, but kind of give us the backstory. Pulls out to what you're doing, how it happened, where you're at today, and kind of what you're looking at doing going forward here.
Yeah. Oh, I appreciate it. And by the way, thanks for having me on the show. I'm really looking forward to the interview and hopefully we can deliver some value. But just going back to a little bit of my history, I was in college in 2005, 6, 7, 8. And during that time in university, my stepdad, who is a general contractor, and he's always been a real estate investor on the side, he's always tried to get me to do the same thing. And when I was in high school and stuff, I resented it, or I wanted to hold back. I really wanted to have my own path, but it was nearly impossible because I've really, like you said, I've really only done two things, and that's either been working with my dad in construction, having my own handyman company, or managing larger construction companies, all of the remodels on roofing, exterior, siding, fencing, stuff like that, with what you do mostly hail claims. And so just multi-million dollar projects. So I grew up with these two things. And it was in college in 2005 that I bought my first real estate. And I remember when I sold it in 2007, I made more on that one project, that one thing that I just held, than I had made in a whole years of income. So I really in 2007, really started seeing the power of real estate and stopped resenting my stepdad so much for trying to get me to do the same thing. And I said, you know what, I'm going to do it. And so I don't know if the listener has heard of the book Rich Dad, Poor Dad from Robert Kiyosaki or not, but it was a book that was really pivotal to me and really helped me grow. As I read that, it told me that I needed to, you know, run my own company so that I could make leverage other people's time and other people's efforts as well as my own. As on top of that, getting the tax benefits of being a business owner versus just working for somebody else and paying high taxes. So I started doing that, and as I understand it, a lot of your listeners are very similar. But the interesting thing is, I started doing multifamily investments in 2007. Where at first it was just managing other people's investments. And then I bought my like first three unit. It was easy for me to kind of focus on something that small. But I was able to purchase that first property. And since then, I've been involved with well over 1,000 apartment units. You know, to this day, I own a few houses, but it's more apartment communities where it's larger apartments. And for the listener, I think there's two really good helpful things is these private placements that I'm a part of. I've been on like both sides of them, either running the show and taking passive investor money to be able to provide a return. Or I've also been on the side where I just had too much money. And so I needed to hurry and put it with somebody else, a different operator, before I went and bought something stupid like a Ferrari in cash. You know what I mean? So I think it's been really beneficial to be able to see on both sides of it. And I hope that I can help with the listener to be able to kind of understand what part they might fit into if they wanted to leverage a resource like these private placements and apartment communities.
Yeah, that's great. That, you know, that hits right in a question I have right off the bat here. You know, I love that you started with that kind of three unit complex, because even in my book, I talk about, you know, being the multifamily, or, you know, not the multifamily, you know, the multifamily units, things like that, as a good vehicle. And it's interesting, you know, when you started and you got that first one, you got that three. Let me ask you, what was the involvement, your actual involvement in kind of a, and I'm going to just use the word day-to-day basis, okay? Were you able to have this, someone else managed it? Were you in there? Because here's the question you always get. Am I going to be in there fixing a broken toilet at 2 a.m? You know, so that kind of thing. So let's kind of talk about the, you know, the strategy and that kind of that aspect of what this entails, because that's usually the first question I get when people talk about this stuff.
Yeah, actually, I feel like I made a mistake on that first one with the level of involvement. And so I love the question. What I did when I first bought that is I looked at the total income. The total income was about $3,000 a month for the three units. So I think there was like a $1,200, another $1,200, and like an $800 in the back, or something similar. There was a three bed, a two bed, and a one bed. It's been a lot of years since then. That's why I don't remember the exact, but the point is, with this $3,000-ish that was coming in, I remember thinking to myself, all right, if I do all the managing my own self, I should be able to keep that $300. But if I hired a property management company, then that would go to them. And so it wouldn't technically be an investment anymore. I remember just really feeling like I needed to do it. And honestly, if I look at the one thing that I would have done differently if I started that again, again, I was young, I was still in college, and 300 seemed like a lot for me to give up to a property management company. I've planned on living on site, so it seemed like it would be a lot easier for me to manage it myself. And so that was my decision. And the problem comes in part by just the economy at the time in 2008, 9, 10, and 11, where there was still a lot of people that they were out of work. They had lost their job and they couldn't really afford their rents. And I remember having that as part of what was holding on to me, because as soon as I found somebody, I just let them in. I skipped the, I was in property management before I managed my own, so I thought that I'd be really good at it. But the problem is when you have an opportunity, when somebody moves out and things are tight, you might make a decision like I did originally, where I just said, all right, I'm just going to pick the first person that says that they can pay that amount. And I'm going to opt to not have everybody filling out applications, because that just slows me down. I remember thinking all these things. And so I did the management, and then coupled with the economy, and also coupled with my personality to just want to be there for everybody. And it was really difficult for me when a tenant comes and says, hey, I'm not going to be able to pay my rent until Friday, or I'm not going to be able to pay my rent until the 15th, or hey, I'm behind on my rent, but I'll give you both months next at the first of the next month. My normal response was, okay, no problem. Like, I don't want to cause any problems. I don't want to evict you. I don't want to go through that time or that effort. So I frequently opted for whatever was easier. And what was normally easier is just say, okay, you know, just agree with everything that they said. And then the other problem is that it put me into a fairly bad position, and I was struggling because I couldn't do all of this on my own. And the real truth about it is that $300-ish that I thought that I would be netting, I ended up spending so much time and effort on my own because I didn't hire a property management company, that technically when I was doing work at my own apartment, my own threeplex, my own little multifamily, technically when I was doing work, I was getting paid well under minimum wage, maybe even less than half of the value of minimum wage. I could have easily just put more work into my business at the time. And, you know, I was making hundreds per hour in my business, but when I was working for my own apartment, my little multifamily, I mean, I was making peanuts. So number one, it would have been just easier to offload it. Then I wouldn't have had to be the person to make all those decisions. And the property management company would have been less likely to let just anyone in. And then on top of that, if when I had to evict, I didn't really know how to do the eviction process myself. And hiring an attorney at this late in the game was going to cost so much more. Well, what I realized is that property management companies, they are ready, and they already know the laws. They already know the process and the procedures to do for eviction. And so if you just have a property management company, it's going to save you so much money during the eviction process that it makes it not worth it to manage it yourself. So to answer your question, did I manage it on my own or did I hire it out? I manage it on my own, but I don't recommend that to the listener. I recommend that the listener has a professional property management company that has good contracts, good applications, as well as a good legal team to be able to complete the evictions for less money than it ended up costing me.
Yeah, I see. I'm with you. I'm big on delegating, right? That's what we teach in my ETOP Academy. It's always about we need to delegate. We want to outsource what we can. You know, again, we want to focus on what we do best, our top 5%. You know, we focus on that. You know, we don't do the accounting and we don't do that stuff. And that's why I asked that question right off, because I think it's for like me, if I invest, I do not want to do that. I do not want to miss. It's not my wheelhouse. I don't want to deal with it. And for me, that'd be just like you found out. And I think everyone else would find out, you know, that do it yourself, even though you're like in the trades, you actually may build things and stuff like that. But again, we're getting back to being a business owner. And I think, you know, tell me if you agree with this, obviously as you invest, you need to keep that same attitude, right? You're not going to be in the day-to-day. You're not going to handle those calls. And you said, and I agree with you, Adam, the worst part is that eviction aspect, that saying, no, I need to rent today, you know, oh, take another month, because you know where that goes. Okay. That 1 month turns into two and three, then you got 3 months to evict them, and you got this, you know, it's just for the money you lose is just unbelievable. Like you said, and I just want to reemphasize the point of those management companies. They're very, very valuable if you've got the correct one, right?
100%. And I didn't know about these back then, but this is like what Robert Kiyosaki was investing in. So he did his business and then he invested in apartment communities, but through private placements versus owning them himself. So there is even another step farther with what we call passive income. So you can either buy the rental and then kind of manage the manager on your own and make some of the decisions and have a lot of support. But there is even another level of passive income where it's so passive that you don't even have to think about the tenants and toilets. You really are investing kind of similar to what you do in the stock market. For example, there's an apartment community that is being purchased by a team, and that team allows for passive investors to be part of it. And you might make like 16, 17, 18% returns annualized by partnering in with somebody else who does all of the work. which I think is a lot better than some of us who want to buy like a single family house in our neighborhood, where sometimes those returns are only going to be 1 or 2% annually. So we can really amplify what we can make and amplify our own time freedom too by doing private placements.
Yes, you know, now my interest is very piqued on that. So that, to me, it seems like a no-brainer, okay? I mean, I take that, you know, I'll do the 16, 17%, someone else handles it. So, but let me ask you on that, you know, what, because everything is risk, right? There's an element of risk to everything we do in life. You know, what, give me a couple of downsides of that, just being straight up, you know, I mean, there's, yeah, everything sounds great, but what are some of the downsides of that approach, doing being the passive?
Okay, the first major downside can be vetting the market. The second one is vetting the team appropriately. And the third would be vetting the deal. And so with that said, as you can tell by how I'm talking, you have like a little bit of work. As I mentioned before, you don't have any of the day-to-day. You just have the upfront work where it's doing your own due diligence. But these three pieces are pretty critical. If you make a mistake on them, then it could cost you money. For example, there's a lot of markets. So we're talking about the downsides. And I said, number one, vetting markets. Number two, vetting operators. Number three, vetting the deal. So talking about vetting the markets, if you notice that there's always several markets, there's 50 states plus, you know, DC and everything else. So you've got different places where you could go. And some of them are, there's people moving into the market, and some of them there's people moving out. At any given day, there's people moving. And as we've seen over the last few months, tons of people have moved out of Connecticut. They've moved out of New York. They've moved out of some of these other markets like California, and they're moving into Texas. They're moving into Florida. They're moving into Colorado. They're moving into Idaho. They're moving into Utah. So some markets, they're not always created equally. And so one of the biggest downsides of a PPM, and I say this as the short for private placement, because we use a private placement memorandum from the attorneys. One of the biggest downsides is you're looking at markets like they either have a headwind against you or a tailwind benefiting you. And so regardless of where you go, the operator is going to be working hard. The operator is going to be working hard and effortlessly, lots of effort, the opposite of effortless. And so the operator is going to need to do their business. But if that operator went to a crappy market where you had a headwind, they might be doing, like, let's talk about it, an airplane for a second. The airplane might be traveling at 400-ish miles per hour on its own, but with a really nice tailwind, you're able to make up more more ground, more air, and much faster. But if you go into the wrong market, then you actually have the market hurting you, even though the operator's still working. So one of the biggest downsides is a passive investor who wants to be part of one of the PPMs, but they don't really spend the time looking at a good market. The big issue, like I mentioned, is if you don't do that, you might have a tailwind, and the business plan that the operator wants to achieve might not even be capable. And so if we have time in this episode, I can share with you like a few big things that you should do to be able to analyze the market a little bit better. But just know that every market is not created equally. The second part was the operating team. And I've seen operators that have done a securities violation. What that means is they've raised money from other people illegally in some way, or they haven't been a good steward of the money and they're trying to gather the money. So I would say not all operators are created equally. And if you want to know one of the biggest things that could, where you could lose your money, it's if you get into business with an operating team that isn't doing the right things. For the most part, the SEC, that's the Security and Exchange Commission, for the most part, the SEC does a lot of the vetting for things that are the opposite of private placements. These are called public companies, which are basically traded on the stock market. So when it comes to these larger public, yes, certainly you could still have issues, but the SEC does a lot of stringent looking at that company to make sure that they're doing well. Plus, they audit their books usually annually or even quarterly. And so when you get into a private placement, you don't have that peace of mind from the SEC making sure that audits happen on a regular basis. And you have more people that might have a little bit less, I guess the best word would be experience. They don't quite have the experience as maybe some other teams, but they're doing the same thing. And so you're running into these risks. So the best way to mitigate that is by spending time to vet the operator. And the number one best way that I would say to the listener that they could do that to really understand if they're working with a good team is by spending enough time to do a social audit on them, to search for them on Google and things like that. Plus, making sure that they get feedback from previous customers, others that might have invested with that operator to see what their experience is. Because I've seen all sorts of issues happen from some companies. But even still, I think that if you can find a good company that you're working with, you're probably going to be safe. And the third thing that could happen is making sure that the property itself is underwritten appropriately and you've done your due diligence. Things that could happen that could be bad on an apartment community would be like drainage, for instance, not just talking about the gutters off of the roof, which I think a lot of your listeners understand completely, but additionally, just making sure that the grade goes away from the property instead of toward the property. Because though even on an apartment community, a very slight grade that comes toward the apartment community can really get a lot of water into the foundation, into the basement, into the garden level units. And that can cause things like mold, et cetera. So as you're doing your due diligence on the property, you want to make sure that those major systems are good to go. And you want to make sure that the operator looks inside, all of the cupboards, under the kitchen sink, under that cupboard or the bathroom sink where there could be leaks. So in short, you want to make sure that the operator is doing a really good job with these things. What my company does is when we're doing the due diligence, we actually invite our past investors if they'd like to. If they would like to learn or if they'd like to see it on their own, they can. And some operators offer that. You just need to ask them if you can go. You also just want to make sure that they have professionals looking at every inch of the property. If it's a 200-unit apartment community, then they're going to check out 200 units. Not 199, not 50% of them, but they actually have to check out every single unit and every square inch of every unit. That's really critically important. And you want them to have professionals like actual plumbers and electricians and roofers, et cetera. You want professionals to be looking at this. So those are kind of like the major things that you will want to look at when it comes to protecting yourself by making sure that it's that the market is a market with a tailwind, that the operator has experience and integrity, and then finally that the property itself is in good condition, understanding that if it's not, that's also a value add opportunity. But if the property's not in good condition, you just want to make sure that the money is there for the value add, which a lot of operators do that too. I hope that was concise. I don't want to confuse the listener, but those are the three major things that I would say could cause risk.
No, I think that was really good, Adam. I mean, that was concise, right? Because I think a lot of that stuff they don't get. Now, it's something as simple as like when you said the drainage, like I get that because I, grew up and I had landscape issues. That's like first things I see when I walk on properties, and I understand it. But these are really good points to understand. And like you said, that every unit thing is a big deal because you get renters who actually take care of stuff. they literally like a nice place, and they'll you know, they don't bother, because I've done it when I was younger. I'm not going to bother the landlord. I'm going to fix this thing because I can fix stuff, right? So I do stuff. So you could get those choice units that are like, you know, in better shape than others, but the, you know, there could be an outstanding issue that was because of you know, a repeated installation issue, right? And they duplicated times 200. Right. So they're all going to have the same problem. So I think it's really good that you you brought that point up, you know, and as anything, we're always looking to get that feedback, like you mentioned, from previous investors, right? Previous or current, right? You do both if you can, and kind of see what's going on. We do it in our businesses, right? We have referrals. We have references. People want to call people we don't work for. It's no different in investing, I see, you know, and I think it's really important, because that's where you're probably going to get your realist, your most legitimate feedback on the opportunity, right?
Yeah. I mean, a quick tangent on that subject is that there was a gentleman that seemingly had a really good following and a lot of people that seemed to like him. And about 2 years into it, I wanted to partner with him. And so I actually was planning on bringing some of my passive investors that wanted to do a deal. I didn't have one at the time, and he did. So I thought, hey, you know what? I will partner in on this deal. And so I started to do that. And as I did research by talking to their current investors and some past investors and past co-partners, I started to find a really common ground where people said that they didn't communicate enough, and people suspected some type of fraud. And so I pulled out of it immediately. That was tough for us to pull out because I already was starting to tell my past investors, and we actually had already raised the money too, but was already telling my past investors that this was the thing. And then I found that out during my due diligence. So we decided to pull the plug really, really, really fast. So it can happen. It is real. The problems do exist, but if on the flip side from this one guy, on the flip side, I've went to work with other teams where it was impeccable and had a lot of really good feedback. And that really helped us to be able to know that we were going to be protected.
Yeah, that's good. So it was almost, you know, I don't need all the details here, but like even unsubstantiated in a sense, right? You had to verify. You kind of went with your gut on that one, right? With this guy, when you start seeing the little flags, that's not one thing. And all of a sudden it's two and it's three. And you talk to more. You don't, and I don't know what you did, but like you didn't have the hardcore, like, you know, he's not in court. He's none of that stuff. But it's important to understand that you need to trust that gut,
yeah.
Right?
In a
sense,
yeah,
because
right.
We do it with customers, right? We do the same thing with customers. I've been in deals, you know, I'm ready to sign a deal. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to, you know, or even in the process, I'll price myself out. You know, I'll make sure I don't get this because there's something just not right about this. And I'm going to be better. I'm going to save a lot of money and time and headaches by not being part of this. So that's a good move on your part. And I guess I would contribute that to your experience, right? Is that something that you had learned over time and the kind of things just weren't lining up?
I definitely did learn that we needed to ask those questions to the people that are working with them and get the references. I learned that over time. And I learned that after, you know, really, I had a podcast on apartment investing show. And so I learned that over time in interviewing people, and it just gave me the opportunity to practice what I preached. And so it's kind of funny. I didn't expect anything negative to come back at all because this person had a good reputation out in the public eye. But I started spending time with people that had worked with them, and it was interesting to find that there was a different consensus for the people that were really close. So yeah, I learned it over time. But for your listener, they don't have to learn that over time. If they listen to this episode and hear how it can really benefit them, then hopefully they'll learn it today.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to point that out. You know, there's no substitution for experience, but like you said, when you're getting into this, these are just great tips, and this should be any due diligence, right? If we're ever investing money, we're going to team up with someone, there's always the due diligence aspect that, you know, more times than not, without doing that, you get burned. Then it's become successful, right? So it's just wise practice, you know, to do that due diligence. I mean, because you're making large investments, right? I mean, this isn't a small investment in this. So, and then let me ask you, as you team up with these operators, as you're calling them, that depend on the size of the operator and what they're doing, but there's going to be continual additional opportunities, right? I mean, do they start bringing these opportunities to you? Do you got to kind of bring it up, or is, you know, are you going to be presented on a regular basis with new opportunities?
That's exactly right. So as you kind of get into the world of private placements, you'll find somebody like our team that offers these opportunities, and you might jump on our list and you might kind of spend time calling us or emailing every now and again. Hey, do you see anything in the pipeline? When you're ready, because I know a lot of roofers that might make a couple of million dollars on one project. They net multi-millions, and what are you going to do with all that money? You got to get it somewhere safe, somewhere where the money works for you, right? So I would just say that once you get in with one of these companies, you can start communicating with them, asking them what's coming up. And something that I've done multiple times as well as an operator myself is, if I don't have a deal right now, but you're calling me saying you need to deploy some capital and start letting that money work for you, what I've done is I put you in touch with an operator that I trust, somebody that I know that has a deal right now. So once you kind of get into the world of private placements, it makes it a little bit easier for you, because you're absolutely right. When I have a deal and it's ready to go, what I generally will do is I'll send it out to the past investors that are on my list, and I'll let them know about the opportunity in case that they're liquid and ready to be part of something like that.
Yeah, it's just a good point. Because you're absolutely right about, in the contracting business, like I said, whether commercial, residential, whatever, and I'm using my own past experience too, we make some money. Okay, like you said, you can make seven figures on a single job easily, right? And you really need to have a plan for this. I talk about that a lot in my book, because it's a Parkinson's law thing, right? If you don't have a plan for that money, it will literally evaporate. It'll just be gone. You'll spend it, you'll buy dumb things, and it'll be gone. When a big chunk like that, they have an opportunity like what we're talking about here, is a way to set yourself up in the long run for just, it's amazing, right? I mean, it's, I think it's an incredible opportunity that shouldn't be overlooked. I think it's one of those vehicles that, like you said, whether it's the 15, 16, 17% return, that's pretty amazing, right? So let me ask you, Adam, going forward, from a longevity standpoint on a property, how long, if you get into something, is this something you'd stay in? Well, I'd be into it 5 years, 10 years, 30 years, or is it all going to just depend on basically, like you said, the property? Are people moving out? Are they coming in? Does neighborhoods change? Things like that. So is there a general time frame that someone in the private placement would stay in on an investment?
There is. There's a couple different strategies that you look at. So I'm gonna say, strategy number one, strategy number two, and then I'll talk about the Goldilocks, which is right in the middle. So strategy number one is a cash flow a play or a yield play. Basically what you're looking for in this type of a property is to just get your residual income every month or every quarter. And so these yield plays are usually nicer properties that don't need very much work at all. And you're buying it at a price where you just get a little bit of a yield on a regular basis. And to me, when you use a yield play, there's almost no risk at all. And then when we look at the opposite of it, which is going to be a value add play, a value play, some people call it, this is more like a fix and flip, where you go in and you put a whole bunch of money into a property, you reposition that property from what it's achieving now to something higher. It takes more time, it takes more capital. And if you're doing it during a market cycle where there could be some risk, then you might not make quite as much as you're expecting to make. But just like with when you just go buy a regular old rental, let's talk about single family. When you buy just a regular rental, you buy it at a decent price, it cash flows, that's fairly low risk. But when you're going to actually do a fix and flip, I've heard of people on a single family house trying to do a fix and flip, even if they're contractors in some cases, where they might lose $100,000 instead of make $100,000. It can be such a large swing. And so there can be more risk, but the overall reward is pretty high. And so we'll talk to you about the Goldilocks, which is really what my company tries to find. What we do is we try to find something that's yielding some amount of money already, like bringing in a cash flow. But we also see a light value add, maybe not a deep value add, but a light value add, some opportunities to make that and improve that property above where it is today. So it's kind of this Goldilocks that allows you to have the cash flow and be able to reposition the property a little bit smaller, where it's safer because you have the income coming in right now. And it's also great because there's a way to add value to that property as well, but without some of the risks that go along with a more deeper value add. So I think I'm answering your question by kind of explaining that you can do this three different ways. And when we find these Goldilocks ways of investing, it can help the listener that who's wanting to start placing some of this capital. They might be able to put in $50,000 or $100,000. Maybe I'm buying it for $6 million or $20 million that I'm buying it. And I might have, you know, just a large number of passive equity partners, passive investors that want to be part of it, but on the passive side. They want to gain in those returns, be able to have the monthly cash flow with that upside. And so one thing that I think is important to mention right now is, if we go back to the beginning of this episode, we talked about 16, 17, 18% returns. Well, think of it like this. If you're buying one of these yield plays, it's probably not going to have a 16% return. It's probably going to have an 8% return. If you're looking at one of these deep value adds, it might have some risk associated, but you could potentially get a 100% return. You might double your money, is what that means. These Goldilocks ones are the ones that we're looking at, where you get some of the cash flow and some of the upside, and that's where you really hit the 16, 17, 18% returns. But the probability of being able to achieve that is much higher.
Yes, that's a good point. That's kind of how I was looking at it too, you know. So I mean, I like that you've got kind of this Goldilocks plan. I think that, I mean, if you're listening, it definitely seems like the way to go, you know, finding those things. And it's, I think a lot of that too comes down to the experience in the operator, right? Did you understand what a light value add truly is? Because a lot of guys, like you said, they can get into a fix and flip, lose $100,000.
Yeah.
Right. So you really need to understand what a light value add is, right? You can't just, oh, this won't take much. The next thing you know, you're a million and a half in the hole on a large piece of property.
Completely agree.
Yeah, that's good. No, that does answer the question, because, and some people, you know, I'll use the word diversify, you know, maybe you're going to get a little bit of those of the, you know, the yield plays, right? Maybe you're going to get a little bit, because that, you know, hey, 8%, there's still nothing wrong with 8%. Right. You've got that coming in, you know, then you're working the others at the same time, or maybe you're going to work up to those, right? You're going to start kind of on a smaller level and start to build some capital, or as you gain in your business, you can then start up in the game too. And at the same time, you're gaining experience, right? You're starting to deal with it. You might figure out, you know, yeah, I'm making 8%, but they're kind of more of a headache, you know? And again, as you create those relationships with different operators, or, you know, guys with like your group and stuff, is, I think it's a pretty interesting way to go. Like I said, there's always opportunity out there, right? But understanding what the market is, where it's going, is a big part of this play as well, like you're saying, right? You got a tailwind, you got a headwind. What's going on here? And do you advise your potential investors or current investors on these shifts in the wind, let's call them that, right? Is that something you like, you're forecasting, maybe like, hey, we see this happening, we're going to look in this area now, or is that going to affect, you know, their current investment? Is that something you have to keep in communication with?
Yeah, on a regular basis. In fact, you're dead on. So what my team is always constantly doing is evaluating different markets. So we there's a few ways that we do that. There's other companies that all they do is just provide the resources. And so we'll pull all of that data and we'll spend time looking at it on our own as well. And then we will do further, people call one of these things list stacking. When you're using it for marketing, you take a list of this type of person, take a list, and anybody who shows up on more than one list is probably a good person to go with. We do a similar thing with when we're looking at markets. So we'll look at markets where it has a good rent to buy ratio, where we really do want it to be a little bit less expensive in markets to be able to rent versus purchase, because that will help with the longevity of having somebody stay with us, right? Because if it's cheaper to buy, then they're only going to stay just as long as they can afford to finally be able to purchase. But in these places where it's prohibitive to buy, it really benefits us to be able to keep those people in for a long time. I neglected one thing a moment ago to really sum up the how long people were going to stay in these properties. I apologize for neglecting it, but I think it was a great question. And I think I stopped short at your last question. With the value play, you're looking at like a 2 to 5 year hold period. With a hybrid play, where it's a little bit of a yield play and a value play, it's that Goldilocks, you're usually looking at a 4 to 6 year term, maybe right around 5 years. And for the yield play alone, where you're just gaining the capital and you're not trying to re-improve the property, maybe you're looking at 7 to 10 years of a hold time for that as a passive investor or at the operator. I mean, the hold time is about the same. So if you want it to be a little bit longer, that's the play that you go through. But anyway, yeah, we're talking about making sure that we're going to be safe and protected when we invest in these deals. And there's a lot of things to look at with the market, making sure that we have a tailwind. And I mentioned one of them, but another big one, we've danced around it, but we haven't really directly mentioned it. But it's really just the overall population growth. So for instance, like in some markets, you're growing 1% year over year. That's a fantastic, phenomenal thing to be looking at. You want it to be growing 1% year over year. And in other markets, it had a spike of 10%. That spike of 10% doesn't necessarily say anything good yet. You want the consistency in the growth in a market. And you, on top of that 1% year over year population growth, you also want to look at a 2% year over year job growth. You want jobs to be growing 2% year over year for multiple years. Not just that they had a spike of 12% last year, but you want to see that they're growing every year 2%. This really helps you understand that it's a strong market that has a tailwind. Another couple of things, I'll talk about schools and I'll talk about the population number overall, because we talked about population growth, but I also want to make sure that your listener who becomes a passive investor, that they're investing in a market that has at least 100,000 people in the MSA. It basically means if it's Dallas, the MSA is also Fort Worth and the other cities right around Dallas. So if the MSA, or the Metropolitan Statistical Area, is the core city plus the suburbs, has at least 100,000, that's your minimum. My company, we only look at if it has 1 million or more, because that we feel like that's even stronger. But for your listener, do not go and invest with a company where the MSA is, you know, 10,000, 2,000, or 20,000 people, because you're not going to be able to have much of a sustainable product there. And there's so many more that we can look at, but those are a few of the real key things to look for in a market to make sure that it has a tailwind versus a headwind against you.
Yeah, those are really good tips there, because it, you're right. They're not something a 10,000 town can get taken out by one industry leaving. You know, they could be, it's interesting, you're just saying the 10 or 12% growth, job growth, instead of the 2% a year. You know, Amazon can drop in, put a distribution center and hire 900 people in a month. And that looks like, you know, that's when you get that big spike, right? But at the same time, again, what happens next year and 4 years from now? Now you got the same thing. And I think what you're saying with that 2% growth and a 1% growth and a 2% business growth, that 2% business growth is going to continue to draw the 1%, right? That's kind of how it works, because people are attracted to the area for the jobs. And of course, as you mentioned, the schools. You know, I have the town I live in, it's Beloit, Wisconsin. They're doing amazing things, right? They've got the story, you're doing everything else, but their issue is the school system, right? They're doing high tech stuff here, Rakuten, all this other stuff is here, but the people are having a hard time coming here and living because they don't want to be in the school system. So I know you're going to address that. So I think why don't you give us a little pointer on the school system stuff too?
Yeah, maybe the quickest way to vet the school system is by searching for the address that the operator is giving you where you're going to be closing on this apartment community together, where you're more of a passive and they're an active investor. You want to just maybe look that area up and look at the, there's three major things that you're going to look at, the elementary and then the middle school and then the high school. It's less important to be looking at the universities in the area. You can still look at that and you can get a lot of good data from it. But the three most critical ones are going to be your elementary, your middle school, and your high school. And the metrics that you really want to be looking for is none of those schools that apartment community will be have the kids bus to. None of those schools, the elementaries for that apartment community or the middle schools or the high schools that apartment the apartment community will go to, none of them should score anywhere below 6 out of 10. And so you can look at this, some schools, when you go look at the schools, they'll either be measured out of 5 or they'll be measured out of 10. So if they're measured out of 5, just double it, and that's how you can see. Mostly for our, what we do in my company is we look for nothing below a 7 out of 10. We like 7, 8, and 9 out of 10. And we want to make sure that the elementary, the middle school, and the high school are all 7 out of 10 or more. And we love seeing 9 out of 10s or even a 10 out of 10 school in that area. But we like to make sure none of them are below 7. For you, the passive investor, just make sure nothing hits below 6. And one of the big things that you'll notice happen with good schools versus schools that are behind is, regardless of where the crime is today, if you have good schools, over time, crime is going to be getting better. It's going to be diminishing, and you're going to have a safer area. Regardless of where crime is today, if you have bad schools, crime is going to get worse over time. And so this one metric can really solve multiple other metrics, because you know that it's a place where people want to live and where they're probably going to be wanting to live for years down the road. So,
yeah, that's what I wanted to bring. I'm glad we kind of touched on it here near the end here, because it is, and that's a very good way to look at it. You know, the better the school long-term, okay? It's just like any other investment, right? And that's why people are concerned about the quality of the schools. So I think innately people know this, right? They know that if the schools aren't good, you know, they already see maybe a higher crime rate, but they've never seen bad schools get better crime rates, or, you know, have them go down. Like you're saying, you know, so that's a great indicator. That's, like you said, that's a really good metric. That's, I love that, you know, and this has been, there's just, Adam, you've given us a ton of stuff here, man. I really appreciate what we're doing here today, because I think this is an incredible vehicle, right, for passive income and everything else. And I think, again, I know a lot of my audience, you know, they're in the position to probably make these moves, right? And this is important. Or if they're growing their business, I want them to have the eyes on this. As I teach in the exit strategy right from the beginning, you know, how are you going to do this? You know, how are you going to create this? And this is one of those vehicles that I think is just from the tips you've given us here and knowing people like you and connecting with people like you, they've got an opportunity to make some incredible gains over a 10, 15, 20, 25 year period in their business. As they're growing this, they're scaling it. Maybe they get ready to sell it, you know, and meanwhile, they're building this passive income. They're getting these great opportunities, you know, that are being brought to them. And it just gives you so much more confidence in your business that I've learned, you know, having that. Mm-hmm. It's a really powerful thing. You know, then when you get that big sale at the end of your business, now you've got a lump sum that you can then, like you said, now you can put that into even more and create more of that income. So it's just tons of value here today, man. I really appreciate it.
It's been exciting to be part of the show. So thank you.
Yeah, you bet. So here's what I want to do. Why don't you give out your links? I'll put all this in the show notes too, okay? Of all your info, everything else. But people maybe they want to follow you, get in touch, however you want to do it. I know you're doing a lot of stuff. You've got your podcast stuff and everything else, which is really cool. I'll be talking to you about that. I'll be on your show, you know, so yeah, That'll be fun with that as well. So, but let's give that out so that people got a way to get to follow you and get in touch.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, I'll just mention two things. The first would be a giveaway that we have that talks a little bit more into detail on vetting the deal, the market, and the team. It goes through the rest of the information. So they would text the word passive to a certain number. I'll give you that information so that can just go into the show notes. In case Great. They want that resource, they can just get it for free. And then the only other thing that I'll share is just our website. It's realbluespruce.com. And if they go to realbluespruce.com and they wanted to be on one of these lists to see these private placement opportunities, they would literally just have to click on the button at the top that says get on the list. So realbluespruce.com, click get on the list, and then it really puts you on the list so you can start seeing these types of opportunities. So those are the two things that I could mention.
That's awesome. I mean, thanks for the giveaway. That's super helpful. I mean, people in what we talk about today, information is critical, right? There's a lot of information you need to gather that we talked about, the vetting processes, all the different levels of from yield play to, you know, little yield, the whole thing, the fix and flips and the light value adds, the whole thing. I love all of this. Okay. There's so much. This is a double listen, right? You got to go back and listen to this one twice because there's so much information in this thing, which is good. That's what I like. I love over delivering here. So, but yeah, it's been such a pleasure to have you on. I really appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to share with my audience. I know we get a ton of stuff from it.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the ETOP podcast. Don't forget to subscribe. And if you liked what you've heard, please leave a great review for us. Your subscription and review helps us reach more people so we can show them how to escape the owner prison. Also, check out the links in the show notes about today's guests and more ways to connect with ETOP on social media. Stay strong and keep moving forward with your business. Thank you for listening to the ETOP podcast. Don't forget to subscribe. And if you liked what you've heard, please leave a great review for us. Your subscription and review helps us reach more people so we can show them how to escape the owner prison. Also, check out the links in the show notes about today's guests and more ways to connect with ETOP on social media. Stay strong and keep moving forward with your business.